Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
How did it come about?
Let's have a bit of history.
It is not black and white, is it?
That raises big questions.
There are repercussions around the world.
It's a hugely complicated picture.
The official narrative is somewhat different.
For a greater understanding of the stories affecting our lives, search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We're recording this at 13 hours GMT on Monday the 13th of May. The European Commission condemns a police crackdown on protesters outside Parliament in Georgia. Russian troops are intensifying attacks in northeastern Ukraine, with battles reported in the border town of Vovchansk. And a journalist in China who reported on the COVID outbreak in Wuhan is set to be released from prison. Also in the podcast, as Israel steps up its operations in Gaza, a warning that Hamas is far from being eliminated.
Even though Hamas has suffered major losses in terms of man and materiel, Hamas is still functioning, it's alive, it's kicking, and it's really pushing back.
And
this isn't to say that spending too much time on your phone doesn't make you miserable. It's more to say that when you zoom out and you look at the spread of the internet, on balance, it might be a positive.
New research showing the internet can be good for you. Several years before it first invaded Ukraine, Russia sent troops into Georgia to try to reassert its influence over the former Soviet Republic. But many, particularly young people there, want to escape from Moscow's orbit. And overnight, thousands of Georgians gathered outside Parliament in the capital, Tbilisi, to protest against a new Russia-style foreign agents bill they fear will block their hopes of joining the EU. The government says the law will increase transparency and sent in riot police to disperse the protesters. Around 20 people are reported to have been detained. Parliament is set to vote on the bill on Tuesday. If it's passed, it would label organisations that get more than 20% of their funding from abroad as foreign agents. Critics say it is similar to legislation used by the Kremlin to silence opposition voices.
I am pretty sure that they will take this law, they will make what they want, and we are going to continue our protests as long as we will be able to. We will continue our protests till the elections.
I want Georgia to live in Europe. I do not want to wake up in Russia. And I have this sincere fear, and I want to ask this government, what does it really give you that it costs you our fear?
Well, our Caucasus correspondent Rehan Dimitri is in Tbilisi. She spoke to Rob Young at the height of the protests.
I'm standing outside Parliament and there are hundreds of policemen in their black uniforms and they are facing off against the protesters in their colourful raincoats. So now protesters are chanting Sakartvelo, this is the name of their country, Georgia, in Georgian. And earlier we've heard the chants of slaves and no to the Russian law. So the idea is these protesters, they've spent the whole night outside Parliament. They've been dancing, they've been keeping themselves entertained, and they were hoping to prevent the MPs from the governing Georgian Dream Party from entering the building. But the MPs got inside, and in fact, the Legal Affairs Committee had already heard the third and final reading of the law. It was very swift. We saw some live pictures from inside Parliament, half-empty hallway. Opposition MPs were absent from this third and final reading. And where it's all heading now is the final vote that is expected on Tuesday.
Right. This is the controversial bill that is at the heart of this dispute. It requires organisations that get more than a fifth of their funding from abroad to register as agents under foreign influence. And the protesters say this would be repressive legislation. They're calling it the Russian law. Is there any prospect at all, then, that this won't become law?
It looks very unlikely that the government will change its mind, judging by all the statements that we've been hearing in the past few days. But also, I want to remind the listeners that there has been a major intimidation campaign unleashed against the opponents of this bill, against opposition politicians and activists. In the last few days, a lot of people were beaten up. They were getting threatening calls, sworn at and being told not to attend these rallies. Yesterday, the Interior Minister came out and reminded the protesters that they might be jailed for up to 4 years if they damage any of the strategic buildings. So there's quite a lot of threat that is coming from the authorities. But despite all of these, people are here and they're protesting because they believe that this is a turning point for their country. They believe that if this law gets adopted, it's going to indicate a major foreign policy change for Georgia, even though the government denies it. The government says it's not a pro-Russian law, we're still going to join the EU, but that's not what the protesters believe in.
Rehan Dimitri in the Georgian capital, Tbilisi. In our previous podcast, our defence correspondent reported from inside the border town of Vovchansk in northeastern Ukraine as Russian troops advanced. Now, Moscow says its forces have entered the town, some 45 kilometres from Ukraine's second city, Kharkiv. Vovchansk has been heavily bombarded, with Russia reported to be using glide bombs. Ukrainian government adviser Yuri Sak said that despite the loss of several villages in the region, Ukraine remains confident.
It is very serious. We are realistic about the assessment of the situation. But at the same time, there is no need for panic. We are sending reinforcements. More reserves are coming. We are expecting more military support from our allies to arrive. So the situation is under control.
We got an update on what was happening in Vovchansk from our Ukraine correspondent, James Waterhouse.
It seems that the fighting is only intensifying. This is a town that has come under what's been described as unprecedented bombing. You have this claim that Russian forces are now in the city. You have that disputed by Ukrainian forces. It's a familiar kind of pattern of claim and counterclaim. And there is an uncomfortable direction of travel along these two incursions that Russia has made into the northeastern Kharkiv region. Now, they may well have taken nine villages and counting, and Ukraine may well say that it is containing them. But there are real fears that if these forces were able to keep going and get within, say, 30 kilometres of the city of Kharkiv, then that would be within artillery range. And then air defences can do nothing about that. And I think people in Kharkiv and other settlements know all too well what happens next. You see it in the eastern Donetsk region, where if Russian forces get close enough, they then lay the cities to siege, they cause immeasurable damage, they make it even more impossible for people to leave there, forcing them from their homes. And in the worst case scenario for Ukraine, you have that optic of Russian troops pinning a Russian flag down amidst a pile of rubble in something they call liberation. So it's not thought this current incursion is capable of taking Kharkiv, but they can certainly cause Ukraine a lot of problem.
Yeah, and how difficult would it be for the Russians to get within artillery range of Ukraine's second city?
That's what is not clear. We've had exhausted, frustrated troops tell the BBC that these Russian troops walked in almost unchallenged with there being so few defences there. If we look at the rate of which Russia is taking territory, who knows? You know, if they're within 40 to 50 kilometres now, we're not talking about much territory, and it is forcing Ukraine to deploy reserve troops there. So two things are clear. Russia is trying to capitalise on that delayed American ammunition and weaponry for Ukrainian troops. And also Ukraine is desperately trying to seek its only goal, really, for this year, which is to try and shore up the line in some way. What is less certain is whether they are able to do that on what is a very unwelcome new axis on the front line.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv. An investigation by Australia's public broadcaster has revealed details of how China's secret police goes after dissidents living overseas. A former Chinese spy now in Australia told ABC News that a unit of the Chinese Secret Service had been in operation in Sydney as recently as last year. From there, Phil Mercer sent this report.
The spy, named only as Eric, describes a shadowy world of deception and abduction. The former Chinese agent has told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation how he'd been ordered by the secret police in Beijing to target dissidents overseas, including in India, Thailand, Canada and Australia. Eric said he would gain their confidence and lure them to countries from where they could be kidnapped and sent back to China. He told journalists that he fled last year to Australia.
Meanwhile, an independent journalist jailed in China after reporting on the first COVID outbreak in Wuhan is set to be released. Zhang Jian served a 4-year sentence after being found guilty of, quote, picking quarrels and provoking trouble. She said she was trying to tell the world the truth.
Maybe I have a rebellious soul. Why couldn't I film that? I'm just documenting the truth. Why can't I show the truth?
Zhang Jian in what is thought to be her last interview before she was detained. I heard more about her and her reporting from our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton.
Zhang Jian was originally trained as a lawyer, but right at the start of the COVID outbreak and those really early days when very little was known, when the city of Wuhan, where COVID is believed to have first emerged, was just in the process of being locked down, she traveled there and started working as a self-starter journalist. And she started filing videos that were shared all over the world on different social media platforms, describing what she was seeing, describing what the people of Wuhan were experiencing, and basically giving a really gutsy counter-narrative to what the Chinese state media was reporting, which was the message from the official Chinese government was, okay, nothing to see here, everything's under control, it's just a little minor sickness, don't worry about this. And Zhang Jian and a few others were giving quite a different story. She filed over 100 videos over the course of a few months, and then she was arrested, and we didn't hear anything else from her again. But really, the key is that she reflected the fear and the unknown, all those details that we didn't know about in the early days of the pandemic. She's one of the very few people who got those details and told that story and got it outside of China.
And just remind us how paranoid the authorities in China were about any unfettered information about COVID coming out at that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was a big deal that her videos were being seen by millions of people, and that really angered the authorities. You know, she was sentenced for picking quarrels and provoking trouble. She was given a 4-year sentence.
Yeah, and do we know how she was treated in prison?
The only things we've really heard of are messages that have been smuggled out via her mother. We believe she underwent several hunger strikes and was force-fed via a feeding tube and lost a lot of weight. But Oliver, I don't think that anybody is under the illusion that even when her official sentence ends today, she will be allowed to continue living her life and will ever work again, either as an independent journalist or as a lawyer. In fact, the group Reporters Without Borders is expressing concern that, like other people who have angered the Chinese authorities by speaking out, she will be sent to some far-off village. She won't really be allowed to resume her contacts with her family or resume any of her former past life. I mean, she really probably will go into some sort of house arrest, we think, after today.
Our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton. The internet and online world in general are frequently cited as the source of all manner of mental health problems. But a study of internet users in more than 160 countries suggests the reverse could be the case. It says the majority of people who use the internet enjoy a higher sense of well-being, though women aged 15 to 24 were the exception. One of the researchers is Andrew Shabilsky from the University of Oxford. He spoke to Laura Maxwell.
This isn't to say that spending too much time on your phone doesn't make you miserable. But it's more to say that when you zoom out and you look at something like the spread of the internet or the spread of being able to use the internet on your phone across the world across the last 16 years, that on balance, it might be a positive, that levels of well-being are between 5% and 8% higher for those that can access the internet and use the internet on a daily basis.
How do you measure that?
Well, with millions of face-to-face interviews. So there's been a long-running study that, again, covers more than 160 countries going back to 2005. And in the midst of asking people about how their lives were going and collecting background in these face-to-face and sometimes telephone interviews, they also asked some questions about how people communicate and how people connect. So what my colleague Mati Viora and I did was we constructed a large statistical model to look at whether or not actually having access to the internet and being able to use it on a mobile phone, really to test, instead of kind of extrapolating from our personal experience of not enjoying our time on social media, let's say, but to look at the big picture.
Well, I was just wondering, you looked at this across 160 countries, and you sort of think, well, we always hear from Northern Europe and perhaps Northern America about the issues that we have with social media. But I suppose just actually being able to afford a mobile phone, being able to get on the internet, improves people's lives across the board if you live in a developing nation.
Yes, that's entirely our way of thinking too, which is to say that we were trying to compare people both within countries across time. So we weren't comparing people, say, in the UK compared to people in France. We were comparing people within a country to each other. So what does it mean to have access to the internet in Nigeria in 2008 versus 2015, let's say? We take a lot for granted about what phones or the internet, the positive roles, the things that it makes easier in our lives. I think we can take that for granted very easily when we focus on the headlines and sometimes some tragic anecdotes.
What were the biggest improvements in mental health that you saw?
Again, not improvements, because it's all correlational. But no, we found that life satisfaction and having positive experiences were the largest differences between people.
I suppose it's just making life an awful lot easier in some situations. Were the findings universal, or did it change depending on what continent you were on?
No, so we did look at all the continents and many, many different demographics and people from different economic and educational backgrounds. And we did the numbers a bunch of different ways. We tested more than 30,000 different ways of analyzing the data. And in half of 1% of cases, we found a negative correlation between internet use and well-being. And this was mostly for young women, 15 to 24. And it turned out that if they didn't like the communities that they lived in, they were more likely to say they regularly use the internet.
Oxford University Professor Andrew Shabilsky. And still to come on the Global News Podcast.
You can create a great drink, but you can also tell the story, because every cocktail's got a story. So what we're looking for is for every day to be a cocktail day.
Shaking up the drinks industry on this World Cocktail Day.
So, how did it happen?
Well, actually, that's a really important question.
The two countries were essentially enemies.
That is, of course, an allegation that has been levelled.
Everybody had a different definition of what the problem was.
Let's remember the background of all this.
The Explanation is the podcast from the BBC World Service making sense of the big stories.
We're finding out why.
What is the evidence?
Let's analyse it.
Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This morning, Israel paused to honour its war dead. But even as Israelis marked Memorial Day, the Israeli Defence Forces continued their operations in both northern and southern Gaza. Rafah, on the border with Egypt, has been a refuge for more than 1 million Palestinians fleeing the conflict elsewhere in the territory. But for the past week, they've faced the agonising decision over whether to move once again. Among them, Khada El-Kurd, who's been displaced several times in the past 7 months.
We were waiting for 3 days to evacuate because we were calling a man with his truck, but he was refusing to come because he said it's a dangerous area. And we have to offer him a huge amount of money in order to come. So instead of paying $100, you can pay $500, 20 or 30 kilometers away from Rafah. And we have to take our essential. In the streets, all of the streets are full of sewage. Whenever you are walking, and in Deir el-Balah also, there is evidence of previous carpet bombing in this area. Like, I was shocked when I came, because whenever you are walking between the streets, you can see destruction of houses, destruction of facilities. It's so hard for us. It's been 7 months we are displaced from north to middle area to Khan Yunis to Rafah, and then coming back to middle area again. It's like exhausted for us. I woke up this morning, I have like a huge pain in my body. I'm so weak. I'm so exhausted. The most of them, they have tents and they are living under the heat, under the lake of water, a lake of food. Now, all of us, we are suffering from stomach disease, from allergy because of the unhealthy condition, unhealthy water. So really we are losing weight. So if we didn't die from airstrikes, the starvation, the famine that will happen.
Khada El-Kurd in Rafah. Well, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the military operation in Rafah is necessary in order to eliminate Hamas, deemed a terror group by many Western governments. But even in northern Gaza, the first target of the offensive, Hamas has regrouped in some areas and continued to launch attacks. Fawaz Jerges is Professor of International Relations at the London School of Economics. Julian Marshall asked him how degraded is Hamas.
Hamas has suffered probably thousands of casualties some of its organized units in northern Gaza and Khan Yunis and central Gaza have been probably dismantled. But this does not really mean that Hamas is not functioning. In fact, Hamas has been able to reorganize itself and to wage guerrilla warfare in northern Gaza, in central Gaza, in Khan Yunis. In fact, all the evidence we have is that Israel really does not control any of the major urban centers in Gaza. There's still major fightings in northern Gaza, major fighting in Khan Yunis and central Gaza. And this tells me that regardless of how many casualties Hamas will suffer, Hamas will be able to continue to wage guerrilla warfare for many years. What Israel does not take into account, that Hamas is not a conventional army, that Hamas basically is a very dynamic social movement. It has prepared for this moment for many years. It's very nimble. And that's why I think that Gaza will likely haunt Israel in the same way that Afghanistan and Iraq haunted the American army for many years.
Israel seems to believe that if it goes into Rafah with a full-scale ground invasion, it will finish the job of eliminating Hamas. But you say that's not the case.
Well, according to the spokesperson of the U.S. Defense Department just days ago, said, quote unquote, that Israel will never defeat Hamas strategically, even if it takes over Rafah. In fact, all the evidence shows that the Israeli army now is bogged down in Gaza. And many American strategists believe that Gaza will likely become a bleeding battlefield for the Israeli army. What it really means that Israel has to occupy Gaza for many years. It has to maintain tens of thousands of forces. Because if history serves as a guide, no army can really defeat an insurgency, in particular a popular insurgency. Particularly an insurgency that's deeply entrenched within the popular groups and populations in Gaza. So even though Hamas has suffered major losses in terms of man and materiel, Hamas is still functioning, it's alive, it's kicking, and it's really pushing back. We have reports of Israeli casualties on frequent basis in some of the parts of Gaza that Israel said it basically was able to cleanse and dismantle the organized forces of Hamas.
Fawaz Jurjis of the London School of Economics. An inquiry here in Britain is calling for a major overhaul of maternity and postnatal care after hearing what it calls harrowing evidence from more than 1,000 women. The birth trauma report is being presented to the UK government today. We heard more from Chichi Izundu.
Let me just start by explaining what might be considered birth trauma. It's a woman's experience of interactions or events directly related to childbirth that caused an overwhelming, distressing emotional reaction. And that can include any injury sustained during birth. This inquiry actually asked for written submissions from anyone that had interacted during childbirth, and they got 1,300 submissions from people who'd experienced traumatic births. It's like you described, the stories in this report have been described as harrowing. They include accounts of stillbirth, premature babies, babies born with cerebral palsy caused by oxygen deprivation. The list goes on and on. And the report concludes that the picture to emerge was of a maternity system where poor care is all too frequently tolerated as normal and women are treated as an inconvenience.
Chichi Izundu. Well, Leah Hazard is a midwife and author. She says the report shows the need for change.
The testimony is absolutely sobering. And unfortunately, a lot of the things that are described in the report are familiar to me and will be familiar to many staff and service users. You know, I've been a midwife for over 10 years, and although most midwives, I get up every morning and try and do my best, I know that things don't always go well. I know that people aren't always treated the way they should be treated, and I know the working environment isn't what it should be. So I think although the report is definitely bleak, it's important that it is so candid because it simply highlights things that many of us have been saying for many years. Women's health and maternity care have just not been valued or prioritized historically by society or by the government. And I think what's shown in this report demonstrates that that really needs to change because that minimization of the maternity journey is taking an enormous toll on the people who move through the system and on those who work within it.
midwife Leah Hazard. Violent crime is likely to be one of the big issues in South Africa's election later this month, with the murder rate there at a 20-year high. Instead of relying on the police, some communities are taking matters into their own hands. As part of a BBC Africa Eye investigation, Ayanda Charlie spent time with two volunteer patrols, a team in the poor black township of Diepsloot and a group called AfriForum, which campaigns for the interests of mainly white Afrikaners.
It's Friday night and 41-year-old Abel Rapelejo is getting his volunteer patrol together.
We stop and search in the township.
He's joined by two dozen men and women. They're all concerned local residents of Diepsloot.
What are you searching for?
The weapons that they might be having. Guns, knives. We are facing the big challenge because Diepsloot is in the hand of the criminals.
60 kilometres away, Johan de Klerk is also getting ready to lead a night patrol. He's in his early 40s and is joined by a dozen people. They're mostly white farmers and are also volunteers from the local community.
What are you looking for?
Faces that is cut. Footprints. The guys will go out to the farms and cut the fences, steal anything that is of value.
It's a few hours into the patrol with Abel. Two local shopkeepers tell him they've just been robbed. They see some people running away and catch one of them.
Just hold that guy.
But the shopkeepers tell them they've got the wrong guy. One of the patrollers starts whipping him while Abel interrogates him.
Why were you hiding? Where are those other guys?
But there's no evidence that this man has done anything wrong.
Are you letting him go?
Yeah, we let him go.
There are clear dangers here. Who holds these patrollers to account?
You beat him.
Yes.
What right do you have to do that?
Remember, Diepsloot is our place. And if we don't fix that, no one will fix this Diepsloot.
Johan's patrol is well-resourced. Most of them carry guns and wear bulletproof vests. An hour into the patrol, they notice something suspicious.
Okay, all right.
What's happening?
This thing has been cut. Yeah, and you can see the footpath. It's well used.
Mm-hmm.
They follow the footpath. It leads to an abandoned building.
The smoke, it means there was recent activity here.
It seems that whoever was here has been frightened off.
Why is there a need for you to do this and not the police?
The police don't have the capacity to do the foot patrols. It's prevention.
Since 2011, the number of police officers has decreased by 7%. Unlike the farmers, Abel's unit is poorly equipped. The risk to their lives is very real. 2 years ago, David's 21-year-old son, Alpha, was shot and killed whilst out on patrol.
Unfortunately, he didn't make it. Or he left a big gap in my life.
No one has ever been arrested for Alpha's murder. According to the South African Institute of Security Studies, the detection rate for murder is less than 1 in 5.
And what do you think of the patrollers?
I really appreciate what they're doing. But I pray day and night that they can be safe. There's no law in this place.
In a statement to the BBC, a police ministry spokesperson said, "While we concede that crime is at unacceptable levels in some parts of the country, aggressive policing interventions have been ushered in to improve the situation. Any member of the community who takes the law into their own hands will face the full might of the law."
That report from South Africa by Ayanda Charlie. Now, here's some news which may interest some of you and even the odd producer of the Global News podcast, because today is World Cocktail Day, an informal anniversary where drinkers have the perfect excuse to swing by a bar for a swift gin fizz or Singapore sling. I heard more from our cocktail correspondent, David Lewis.
Yes, the 13th of May today is World Cocktail Day. Well, why that date? It's all to mark the moment in 1806 when the word was published for the first time in a New York newspaper. The Balance and Columbian Repository tabloid coined the term cocktail as a horse with a tail like a cock, cocked up instead of down. Two things in one, like a good mixed drink. The paper described the booze as a stimulating liqueur composed of spirits of any kind, sugar, water and bitters. The mixed drink actually began life as a British invention, but across the Atlantic, the Americans innovated it. And it was New York barkeeper Jeremiah Thomas whose creations really popularised the drinks. In 1862, he jotted his creations down in his book, The Bartender's Guide. immortalising the thirst quenchers that people still enjoy today. The mint julep appeared in his tome, as did the cognac, brandy and vermouth mix, the Corpse Reviver. Fast forward 60 years to Prohibition era America, where bootleg alcohol, illegally distilled and flogged under threat of a police raid, no doubt wouldn't have tasted that great. So shaken up with bitters and sodas, more classics were created. Rum mojitos, the sidecar and the Tom Collins were popularised then and remain a saloon staple. At the same time in Europe, the trend-setting and hedonistic, bright young things of the roaring 1920s quaffed cocktails for fun, and the drink was here to stay.
So as cocktail correspondent, what do you advise on World Cocktail Day?
Well, there's more emphasis this year on inclusive drinks. So think of gluten-free cocktails, drinks using plant-based milk and other vegan options too. Here in Britain, at least, there's also focus on a move away from sweet drinks towards more savoury inventions. So this year, there's extra attention on the spicy margarita and Bloody Maria. Or why not sup a cucumber wasabi martini this special day? Chin chin.
Well, I may or may not be off to follow that advice from David Lewis. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Sid Dundin. The producer is Nikki Verrico. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
So, how did it happen?
Well, actually, that's a really important question.
The two countries were essentially enemies.
That is, of course, an allegation that has been levelled.
Everybody had a different definition of what the problem was.
Let's remember the background of all this.
The Explanation is the podcast from the BBC World Service making sense of the big stories.
We're finding out why.
What is the evidence?
Let's analyse it.
Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.